From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young, broadcasting today from WBHM in Birmingham, Alabama.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Let's get right to the unfolding events in Venezuela today. Opposition leader Juan Guaido has called for a military uprising to oust President Nicolas Maduro.
Cuando la comunidad internacional respaldara ampliamente.
Guaido posted a video online this morning standing with soldiers at a military base in Caracas to launch what he has called the final phase of the effort to force Maduro. I spoke earlier with Stephen Gibbs, who reports on Latin America for the Times of London and The Economist. He's in Caracas.
Well, we've seen really a very dramatic and unexpected turn of events that began a few hours ago here in Caracas, and that was just before dawn. Juan Guaido, who declares himself the rival president of Venezuela, appeared on an overpass overlooking the Carlota Air Base in central Caracas, and alongside him were several defecting soldiers and Venezuela's leading political prisoner, Leopoldo López, who's been under house arrest since 2014. Now, both of them said that they were launching what they called Operation Freedom, the beginning of what they say will be the overthrowing of President Maduro. Now, that didn't work in terms of they didn't manage to get access to the airbase. There was tear gas fired from Maduro loyalists within that airbase. We've also just been seeing in the last few minutes, as I'm speaking to you here, some disturbing images of National Guard, what appear to be armoured personnel carriers, running over what seem to be protesters. I haven't been able to verify those, but those have been circulating on social media. Right now, as I'm speaking to you, the opposition supporters, including Guaido and several National Guardsmen who've rebelled are in one of the main squares of Caracas and are sort of seem to be pondering their next move. So a series of dramatic events here.
Do you get any sense at this point how much of the military is siding with Guaido versus Maduro?
From what we can see, there hasn't been a significant defection from the high command of the military, and that is what Guaido needs. That's what he's been calling for several weeks and months. We haven't had that. In fact, we've had the opposite, that many of the leading, the high command of this of the army have been issuing their or voicing their support for President Maduro. But, you know, we are seeing inside this country relatively junior, but National Guardsmen there who were prepared to flip, and they were all wearing blue armbands, and they are saying, right, we're shifting sides. So, you know, the leadership seems to be with Maduro, but one of the things Guaido has been pushing for a long time is that the junior ranks of the army, they're suffering in the same way that most of Venezuelans are in terms of, you know, very, very low salaries, etc. And if he can get enough of them to come on his side, then things might change. But no, the sort of command of the army remains loyal to Maduro.
And what about ordinary people there in Caracas, where you are? Is there fear about siding with one side or the other right now? Or people, we've been talking for so long about how helpless the situation is there, how helpless the economic situation is there. Are people in Venezuela at a point now where they'll just do whatever it takes to change?
I think there's no question that the real support for Maduro is really slipping. You know, relatively recently, he could legitimately say that 25% of this country were behind him. He'd actually say it was a lot more than that. He claims, of course, that he has a democratic majority here. But, you know, it does appear to be slipping from that, say, 25% of around a year or a couple of years ago. And you really are hard pushed to find people who genuinely say, we like this government, we back them. There is a hardcore, perhaps 10%, but the majority is against him. Now, the majority is also pretty dependent on the state here for food, for the public services, even though they are in a deeply sort of declined state. So, you know, what we've never seen, and I haven't even seen a sign of it yet, today, during this sort of dramatic development today, are the people coming down from the poorest parts of this city and saying, right, we've had enough, we're going to fully join, openly join the opposition. But that is clearly the pressure that Guaido and the opposition are trying to build on. And there is a theory that what happened today is actually a build-up for what will take place tomorrow. There's a massive march planned by the opposition, and this is sort of perhaps publicity for that.
That is Stephen Gibbs, who is a reporter for the Times of London and The Economist in Caracas, Venezuela, as we follow the developments there. Stephen, stay safe, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We'll watch that story, but now to Illinois, which could be the next state to legalize recreational marijuana. Governor J.B. Pritzker saying he wants lawmakers to pass a bill this session. 10 states and the District of Columbia have legalized recreational marijuana use so far, but the research around that has been minimal. And now a private donor is giving Harvard and MIT $9 million to study cannabis and its effects on the brain. This is believed to be the largest philanthropic gift yet to support basic cannabis research, and it's money that comes from investments in the legal marijuana industry. WBUR's Carrie Goldberg has that story.
Manhattan-based investor Bob Broderick made tens of millions of dollars in the legal marijuana industry in Canada, he says. Now, as states around the U.S. legalize marijuana, he's donating $9 million to Harvard and MIT to help fill the major gap in research on how cannabis affects the brain.
I've come to make this gift because I saw an opportunity to take a kind of a leadership position in getting these two great cultural institutions involved in the discussion of cannabis in the country.
Harvard professor of neurobiology Bruce Bean says we know incredibly little about the compounds called cannabinoids in cannabis.
Two of them have been studied in some detail, THC and CBD. Even for those, I have to say, our knowledge is very, very sparse in terms of, you know, how they actually have their effects on the brain. But for many of the other of the 100 cannabinoids or so, we really know nothing.
The National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine issued a report in 2017 saying this is a pivotal time for cannabis research, and the country badly needs evidence on its potential benefits and harms. The National Institutes of Health are supporting more than $140 million worth of research on cannabinoids. But support from private donors has been slow to roll in. Late last year, the online site Inside Philanthropy reported on a gift of nearly $5 million to support cannabis research at UC San Diego under the headline, "Where Most Donors Fear to Tread." Donor Bob Broderick says he thinks that will change as legal marijuana gains popularity.
My thought is that this is the largest gift to support cannabis research, but it's not going to be the largest for long.
Among the research that his gift will support is work in mice at MIT's Picower Institute for Learning and Memory. In a darkened microscope room there, researcher Amanda Vernon is scrutinizing a screen full of brightly colored blobs representing a tiny piece of a mouse brain.
We're very, very zoomed in. This is a hugely magnified image. So this red is one individual cell, one neuron.
That neuron is surrounded by tendrils of green, indicating connections with other brain cells, synapses. Vernon compares the cells of normal mice with mice that have been given antipsychotic drugs. The treated mice are showing better connection.
So these are just normal mice. These are neurons in red and then synaptic staining behind. And then after antipsychotic treatment, you can see there's a lot more green coming up there.
That green suggests that antipsychotic drugs may help patients with schizophrenia by bolstering connections in key brain circuits. The lab's leader, Professor Miriam Heyman, says maybe cannabis hurts those connections.
What if we see that the psychoactive components of marijuana are having the opposite effects of antipsychotic drugs?
That could help explain findings by other researchers linking marijuana use by young people to schizophrenia. And if cannabis does hurt these connections, Heyman asks, might it be possible to counteract or prevent that?
I mean, we're saying, wouldn't it be great to study this? And then this gift comes along and really is enabling to do everything we wanted to do.
With money he'll get from Broderick, MIT professor John Gabrielli will be studying the effects of cannabis in people with schizophrenia and autism. His collaborators have already found that elements of cannabis may be able to improve cognitive function in people with schizophrenia, and the team will be looking for the best mix for optimal effects. Heavy cannabis use is very widespread among people with schizophrenia, Gabrielli says, and it's not clear to what extent cannabis is helpful or harmful to them.
That's why we need the science, because right now it's happening without the science, and it's likely to happen all the more as marijuana becomes highly available illegally in many states.
Legal barriers have long hampered research on marijuana, he says. But as legalization spreads, the need for better science on cannabis becomes ever more pressing. For Here and Now, I'm Carrie Goldberg.
In Birmingham, Alabama, we'll be bringing back a terrific story about the high-tech boom happening here, the hope for the future of the city. But of course, it's a city with a painful past, one of the ugliest in the fight for civil rights, violent suppression of peaceful protesters, lynchings, and then 4 little girls were killed by a Ku Klux Klan bomb.
And they died in Birmingham, at the 16th Street Baptist Church, rallying point of the Negro drive in the nation's most segregated big city. Dynamite exploded on a Sunday morning, killed 4 little girls in Sunday school, injured 20 other Negroes.
Their names were Carol Robertson, Cynthia Wesley, Denise McNair, and Addie Mae Collins. They were 12 to 14. You can feel their presence here at the 16th Street Baptist Church. It feels like sacred ground. When we knew we'd be visiting Birmingham, my first thought was the 4 little girls. I'd always wondered about them. I worried maybe their story was overreported, but people here assured me it wasn't. And as if to prove that point, we met 2 young women, 19 and 22, passing by. Do you have a sense of this church in history? Do you know what happened here?
I don't. I really don't either.
There was a bombing at this church, and 4 little girls in this church.
Oh, I did hear about that. So now that you mentioned the 4 little girls.
My mom told me about it a little bit.
Your thoughts standing here?
It's an honor to be standing here, actually.
It really is. Like, well, I have a 5-year-old sister, so I couldn't even dream about it.
Actually, there was, she's called the 5th girl, and her sister did die, and she survived.
I didn't hear about that one. I just heard about the 4. I didn't know it was like a 5th little girl.
Her name is Sarah Collins Rudolph. Her older sister, Addie Mae, was killed in the bombing. Sarah was partially blinded by the blast. We visited Sarah and her husband, George Rudolph, at their home just outside Birmingham. Are you George?
Yes, I am.
Hi.
How y'all doing?
Good. Hi. Yeah. You Sarah?
Yeah.
There's a clock at the 16th Street Church that's frozen at the moment of the bombing. So is much of Sarah's lovely home. The walls are covered with pictures of all 5 of the girls. We'll post some at herenow.org. We sat down to talk. There are some of us, the names Carol, Cynthia, Denise, Addie Mae. Those are names we'll never forget.
Yeah, you're right about that.
Yeah. But a lot of people don't know the name Sarah.
Well, you know, since I was just a survivor.
You're not just a survivor. No, you're not. You're a carrier of this history.
Yes, I am. I've been carrying it a long time.
Yeah. Mm. Well, and I understand at one point it became a terrible burden. Nobody talked about PTSD back then. Did you ever get treatment for that day?
No. When I got out the hospital, I had to go right back to school, you know.
Do you mind if we go back to that day?
September 15, 1963. We walked to church that morning, real happy. And we got there. We went into the ladies' lounge to freshen up. And Denise McNair, Cynthia Wesley, and Carol Robson, they came. And Denise walked over to my sister Addie and asked her to tie the sash on her dress. And when Addie reached her hand out to tie it, that's when, boom, the bomb went off. So we didn't see her finish tying the sash. The bomb went off and it blinded me in both my eyes.
It blinded you in both your eyes. You're standing there in the rubble.
Yeah.
What happens for you now when you're telling me the story and you're talking about that image of your sister's hand reaching for a sash and then boom?
I always think about it every day, you know, scar.
Every day.
Face. Look in the mirror, I still see the scar. They had to remove my eye. You know, most people put their attention on the one that was killed, and I was just injured.
You talk about your eyes. We're sitting here on your couch, and I'm looking down, and there's the famous photograph that was in Life magazine. It's you in the hospital bed with white gauze taped over both of your eyes.
Yes, I didn't know they even took that. Yeah, I couldn't see.
That picture had a profound effect on people. You know, you did have an impact, Sarah Collins.
Well, that's what they say, but the way they treated me here in the city of Birmingham, they don't acknowledge me as being the fifth little girl.
Talk about that, because whatever doubt people had about what was happening in Alabama with Governor Wallace and Bull Connor, who was the commissioner here, who set dogs and water hoses on civil rights protesters, it really exposed what was going on.
Yes, it did, because the police was involved, the mayor, the governor, they just hate our color. We couldn't even call the police if we wanted. All of them in office with Ku Klux Klan, so we just having a rough time during that time.
Probably the worst Ku Klux Klan in the South.
Oh, yes. Yeah. But, you know, I never know a good Ku Klux Klan, really.
Well put.
Especially when they put a bomb in a church and kill innocent people just because you black. You know, they're racist.
When did you realize that Addie Mae, your sister, was gone?
Well, when my mother told me, after I got through operating on my eyes, I went upstairs. And then that's when I found out that all the girls that was in the restroom with me, they was all killed. And she told me that I was the only survivor in there that morning. I cried all night. I didn't want to be bothered with no one. I was hurt. You in church, you come to church to praise God, and all of a sudden, you don't come out with your sister.
Well, and you were crying through blind eyes.
Yeah, and it hurt because glass was still in my eye. Still got a piece of glass in my left eye. And today, we hadn't got any apologies or nothing from the city of Birmingham.
Nothing ever?
Nothing. No restitution, no nothing. Still paying bills for doctors for my eye.
That's stunning. I'm sorry. Is it any solace that your sister and Denise and Carol and Cynthia did not die in vain, that it really did change history?
No, they didn't die in vain. They was responsible for the civil rights bill being passed. You know, the laws were changed faster because people up north, they seen what we was going through. I just didn't understand. They shouldn't have died to change the laws. They should have been changed.
Well, and it shouldn't be up to four little girls, right, you know, murdered senselessly in a bathroom to change that.
Right. And then, you know, treating us that way, I started to get just like that. I was getting angry with them.
Talk about that, because I understand that, you know, you got no help for what was serious PTSD. There was alcohol, marijuana to try to dull that pain. Didn't work.
Yeah, I did that, but, you know, it didn't do any good till I got myself right with God.
Has it gotten a little bit better? I know in recent years you've spoken up. Do you feel that Ava DuVernay's Selma, you know, maybe got a little bit of it wrong, that there's a bench across from the church that got it a little bit wrong, what happened to you, and you've been claiming, no, this is what really happened?
I had to come out and let them know that they need to get the story right.
Well, because it's your story.
Right.
Can I say something?
Please, George.
They should have consulted with my wife about the story. But I want to say one thing. What my wife went through at 12 years old, she went through Vietnam. She was in an explosion. All that stuff raining down on her. She went through Vietnam at 12 years old.
And you know from whence you speak, you were a Vietnam War veteran.
I know. Yeah. But see, she never has gotten any kind of restitution for what she went through. Like those people went through in New York, 9/11, and Boston Marathon. she still has to go to the doctor and pay out of her own pocket. She shouldn't have to pay for what she went through.
Sarah, we look forward. You're going to be telling your story. You have a book coming out. Yeah. We're talking to you as there was a synagogue bombing outside San Diego, churches shot up in Sri Lanka. You were among the first.
Yeah. Since we have a president now, look like all this stuff coming back because he don't talk against it. The Ku Klux Klan have come out. The Nazis is coming back out again.
And can you tell us one thing about your sister you'd like people to know?
Ada was sweet. She didn't deserve that. She was a sweet girl. Loved everybody. Never heard her say a harsh word about no one. I know she went to heaven. All those girls, I know they went to heaven because they had so much love in their hearts.
Dr. King eulogized your sister and the other girls.
So, my friends, they did not die in vain. God still has a way of wringing good out of evil.
Well, I never did get a chance to go to her funeral because I was in the hospital a couple of months, so I didn't get a chance to meet King.
You were robbed of so much, you know, robbed of that moment, too.
Yeah, I was. I hate I didn't get a chance to go to her funeral.
Do you find yourself thinking, you know, what would Addie Mae be doing now?
Yeah, I always wonder what will she be doing because, you know, we really didn't get a chance to spend much time together. But the little time we did spend together, it was some good time. And I still miss her, you know.
Well, Sarah, you are to us the fifth little girl.
All right, thank you. I thank you all for coming.
Sarah Collins Rudolph, who lost much of her sight, and her sister in the 1963 Birmingham church bombings. By the way, we've called the mayor's office about her request for restitution. We haven't heard back yet.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Ember Wave. Ember Wave, the revolutionary personal thermostat that is designed to help you feel cooler or warmer at the press of a button. Ember Wave can put you in control in places like your freezing office, uncomfortable airplanes, restaurants, trains, cafes, and more. Named one of Time Magazine's best inventions of 2018, learn more at emberwave.com and use code NPR to save $50 at checkout. Ember Wave. Control your comfort.
Let's get back to the unfolding situation today in Venezuela, where opposition leader Juan Guaido is calling for what he calls the final phase of the effort to force President Nicolas Maduro from power. He's trying to get the military to abandon Maduro and side with him. Joining us now is Fernando Cutts, who's a fellow at the Wilson Center and was a senior advisor to former National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster. Fernando, welcome to you. And the Venezuelan foreign minister said today that this coup attempt, which is what it's being called, was planned in Washington. What kind of conversations do you think are going on in Washington right now among the Trump administration about what's happening there? Or how involved have they been in what's going on in Venezuela?
Well, good afternoon, Jeremy, and thank you very much for having me on. You know, I think that the term coup is already a term that's being incorrectly used by the Maduro regime. If there was ever a coup that took place in Venezuela, it was really when Maduro himself chose to ignore the people, ignore the popular vote last year, and decide to stay in power against the will of his own people. And so I think what's happening now is perhaps a military uprising of sorts, where the military is siding with the people of Venezuela and saying enough is enough. The people have suffered for too long, and it's time to stand up to the dictatorship that Maduro has led. The United States has certainly been very involved, along with over 52 other countries from around the world, in supporting interim President Guaido and supporting the people of Venezuela throughout this constitutional crisis of sorts. But at the heart of it, it's a real Venezuelan issue. It's a Venezuelan crisis, and it's going to require a Venezuelan response. And so I think this is what we're seeing play out right now.
So what do you think is going to happen? We've already seen reports today of military vehicles running over protesters out in the streets of Caracas. It's a dangerous situation there. It looks like there are some clashes going on. What do you expect will happen?
It's a very unfortunate situation, and it's unclear at the moment. I think it's one of those things that, you know, we're going to need probably a few hours or maybe a day to let the smoke clear out and actually see what the situation is like on the ground. There's a lot of rumors going around. There's a lot of speculation. Both sides are, of course, engaged in their own kind of version of spinning the events that are happening. But the reality is most likely very messy. I think there are factions of the military that seem to be siding with Guaido, and it's unclear how large those factions are. And there seem to be factions of the military that are still siding with Maduro and are willing to, you know, as you said, plow down the people who are trying to protest in the streets. So I think this will unfortunately be very messy. But it's, I think it's critical that this be resolved in as peaceful a manner as possible and that democracy be restored to Venezuela.
And just briefly, what do you think is at stake around the rest of the world? You've already seen Russia come out and say they're condemning what's going on there. Turkey also not very happy.
Absolutely. I think the entire world isn't happy, to be honest. You know, I think that much we're all united on. The status quo was not sustainable for the people of Venezuela. It was a real humanitarian crisis. We've been seeing images around the world for months now of the incredible suffering, the starvation, the malnutrition, mm-hmm. lack of medicine, lack of basic hygiene. And so something had to change. Whether or not this will be the thing that changes is still, you know, unclear. But ultimately, again, I think Maduro needs to step aside, allow democracy to be restored, and allow humanitarian assistance back into the country.
That's Fernando Cutts, a fellow at the Wilson Institute, the Wilson Center, rather, in Washington. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
We recently paid a visit to West African world music superstar Anjali Kidjo.
Hi. How are you? Wow.
I'm good. Come on in.
Hi. Atri and Anjali Kidjo grew in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
She grew up in Benin during a dictatorship, fled to France, now finds the diversity she cherishes in Brooklyn. We were thinking driving over here that every time we stopped at a red light, a different car pulled up with a different kind of music on the car radio.
Absolutely. That's what Brooklyn is about. Yeah. I love it. I'm surrounded by kids. Regular life, taking the kids to school.
Anjali Kidjo is a personal favorite. When I tried to recall one of her hits, we were blown back by a mini concert.
I've always sung as long as I can recall. I cannot tell you when, how, what. All I knew was every time I was singing, I was feeling good. And I was just that kind of person that want people to have a smile on their face all the time.
That is Celia Cruz, because Anjali Kidjo is doing tribute albums now. Her first, a cover of David Byrne and Talking Heads. Her new album, Celia, is a tribute to the queen of salsa, Celia Cruz. Heard here doing La Vida Es Un Carnaval, Life is a Carnival. What was it about her music that compelled you?
What people don't know is that salsa is huge in Africa. But most of the band that came to play in Benin, they were only male. So for me, salsa is a man business. So come Celia one day, and I went to school and told some of my friends, "Did you see that poster? A woman is singing salsa." And they say, "Angelique, you're so naive, man. She's a backing singer." I said, "I don't care."
Background singer.
Yeah.
Of course she's not. She's like...
But the thing is, the show started, and it's all the guy playing. And my friend was looking at me like, they're making fun out of me. Celia Cruz come out. And I'm like, "Oh, Lord help us. I'm so happy. Yeah! Y'all gonna eat this now, baby." Todo aquel que piense que la vida es desigual tiene que saber que no es así, que la vida es una hermosura, hay que vivirla. Todo aquel... met Celia Cruz in Paris. I love Kimbra. I say, Kimbra? And I start singing my Kimbra. She said, hold it right there. I will invite you on stage and you come and join me for that song. So when she invited me on stage, she gave me the microphone and stepped back. And I go, Kimbra, 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 Kimbra. I was singing something that is not Kimbra. Hey, mama, hey, mama, hey, mama, hey, mama. And I did the whole first verse. And she was like, dying laughing. And then I say, and then I look at her around and say, I'm making a fool out of myself. Here, your microphone, and I run away.
I love Ana Maria, también Joseito, Kimbara, Kimbara, Kimba, Kimbaito.
What was interesting for me is the African identity of Celia Cruz. And the way she sings is like a percussion player from my country. So for me, it was important to dig deep to say to her, from an African sister to another one, this is our culture. So every song on that album have always started with the drums, the horns. We have marching band, everything that can allow me to really go to the source and the foundation of salsa.
Ye manja, ven de la mar. Ye manja, ven a bailar.
Cruz, Miriam Makeba, all those women, through their voice, I've seen endless possibilities. And I fly, and I travel the world. It's also difficult when you are born girl in Africa. I was lucky to be born in the family where I was born, where my mom and dad have given us a platform to speak. When you were born a girl, you don't have an identity as a person. You just belong to your father that can marry you to anyone he decided to.
Well, and in your case too, in Benin, you also belong to an autocratic dictator who wanted all the artists to devote their music to his autocracy, and you refused to do
that.
Oh,
yeah, from day one.
So is that a part of what's happening now? You're doing whatever you want. David Byrne, if you want to do Talking Heads, if you want to do Celia Cruz, you're nodding yes.
I do it because freedom is something that is colorless. And my father have taught me that as long as I do my music, not linking it to a political party, I will have a career. When you link your music to a political party, you lose every way, shape, or form because they come and they go.
Is it true that you were in college, I think, in Paris, and David Byrne's Once in a Lifetime, Talking Heads Once in a Lifetime came on? You didn't even really know what it was about. And to you, it was Africa.
Oh, yeah. I sit up and I start doing dancing.
You're dancing with your shoulders.
I just shaking it, dancing it.
So you fall in love with this song. And then I hear you go to New York. David Byrne becomes someone who is one of your mentors. You still hadn't heard the whole Remain in Light Talking Heads album.
No.
And finally, your husband hears you singing Once in a Lifetime one day and says, you got to listen to this whole album.
And from the first song, Born on the Punches, every word from that moment on resonated in me.
Take a look at these hands. The hand speaks. The hand of a government man. Well, I'm a tumbler. Born on the Punches.
Seven trees, barren, strange fruit.
Angelique Kidjo has also been touring, singing the songs of Nina Simone, who here sings the blood-curdling dirge about lynching.
And blood at the roots.
I have to ask you about Nina Simone. Do you do strange fruit?
I've never been able to. I think that the day will come I will do that because it doesn't come out of my throat. What we do to each other is absolutely ugly. Strange Fruit is one of those songs that is a reminder of the people that say that they come to bring us civilization that conduct themselves as barbarians.
I just got so sad seeing Angelique Kidjo. I don't think I've ever seen you as subdued as you just were in the past couple of minutes. And I'm realizing, for an African woman to think about an African-American anthem, Strange Fruit, of course, about lynching.
It's hard for me because that wound is still open out there. And I do everything that I can in my capacity through music to heal the pain from both sides.
Are there any recordings of your Nina Simone work, or is that more performance now?
It's more performance. I mean, it's going to come one day. For me, it's all about inspiration. I was inspired to do The Remaining Light. I was inspired really deeply to do Celia Cruz. Nina Simone will come one day. James Brown also will come one day.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's so funny. I mean, you're talking about, you've got a two-track mind going on here. You're going to do James Brown. You're going to get down on your good foot. And you're going to keep your eye on social issues.
But James Brown has been also talking about social issues. Say it loud, I'm black and I'm proud. Living in America, it's a man's world, but it would be nothing without a woman or a girl. That an issue that he has been talking about before. Do we listen? We listen, but do we hear?
We will hear it again anew when Angelique Kidjo does it.
I hope so.
Oh, yeah. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And Angelique Kidjo's Celia, her tribute to salsa great Celia Cruz, is out now. And we cannot wait to hear what she does with James Brown. It's Here and Now.
A California man is in custody on charges he was planning a domestic terrorist attack. Authorities say Army veteran Mark Stephen Domingo was arrested last Friday before he could carry out a bombing at a rally in Long Beach on Sunday. He was a recent convert to Islam, and authorities say he had once said he would pledge allegiance to ISIS if the group managed to create a presence in the U.S. Well, yesterday, the reclusive leader of ISIS appeared in a new video, the first time he's been seen in 5 years. In the video, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi said ISIS will prolong its war of attrition until Judgment Day. Joining us now is Colin Clark, Senior Research Fellow at the Soufan Center. Colin, first of all, do you have any doubts about the authenticity of this video?
No, this seems totally legit. That's initially what a lot of folks were worried about and naturally skeptical, given all the claims that, including Russian claims, that Baghdadi's been killed. But it seems to be clear now that this was definitely him.
And so what message do you think he is trying to send?
I think he's got a couple of messages, which are all very interesting in their own right. I think in terms of timing, he released this to coincide with the upcoming Muslim holy month of Ramadan. And that's a period which we typically see a spike of attacks by the Islamic State and its followers. And so I think there's a tactical aspect to his message. It could be a means of rallying his supporters or encouraging those that have been thinking about launching an attack to go forth and do so. I think at a fundamental level, it's to prove to his followers that he's alive, mm-hmm. right? Because there was a lot of uncertainty over he hadn't been seen in 5 years. So to say, no, here's proof of life. And to remind them of the temporal aspect of the fight, that this is, you know, something that's not measured in months or years, but a far longer time horizon. And he stresses that throughout the video, and he attempts to frame the collapse of the territorial caliphate as merely just another kind of, you know, blip in this long journey.
Well, yeah, because we've talked many times before on this program about the importance to a group like ISIS of having an actual caliphate, of having territory that they control. And as we've also talked about, much of that territory has been taken away from them over the last couple of years. How can they make the case to their followers when they don't have a caliphate?
Well, look, Baghdadi and most of the leadership were well aware that this wasn't going to be a permanent thing. They knew that they'd never be able to withstand Western and coalition forces' air power. And so they've been planning for the next phase for quite a while. They've been looking into what it would take to sustain some kind of a guerrilla insurgency in Iraq and Syria. And they've also been dedicating, a lot of attention and resources to their affiliate groups and their franchises all over the world in places like Libya, Yemen, the Sinai, and Egypt, Afghanistan, and other parts of Africa.
So, as you said, al-Baghdadi is talking to ISIS followers in this video. What about new recruits? How do they get people to sign on around the world to carry out terrorist attacks when they don't have that caliphate? Or what message do they send to people that makes them decide, okay, I'm going to join this fight?
So this is a morale boost for the group, especially coming on the heels of Sri Lanka, where a lot of folks in the media doubted that the Islamic State could have played a significant role. We now have learned that at least one of the bombers, had actually trained in Iraq and Syria, was a returning foreign fighter, which is what many countries have long feared. Baghdadi was essentially trying to come out and say, you know, a lot of people are questioning whether or not we can still launch spectacular attacks, and clearly we can, whether those are directed and inspired, or in this case, partnering with local groups in places like Sri Lanka that, to be honest, were really well below most people's radars in terms of countries where the Islamic State would look to launch an attack.
Colin, in a recent article in The Atlantic, you were quoted as saying that, like a headhunting firm, ISIS is targeting people with a background in graphic design and production, people with media degrees. How do they do that, and why do they want that so badly?
So this is something that goes to the importance of what I would call information operations. And I wrote a piece with a colleague of mine named Charlie Winter in War on the Rocks maybe a couple of years ago now, where we identified this trend in the U.S. and in U.S. military circles. We pay a lot of lip service to the importance of information operations, PR, media. But the Islamic State actually dedicates significant resources because they know they're at an asymmetric disadvantage, and they see the return on investment. And the proof's in the pudding. If you look at the Islamic State, there's a lot of hyperbole that surrounded the group. There's two areas to me that I think the hyperbole is warranted. So one is financing. This was one of the wealthiest terrorist groups that we've ever seen. And the other is in the sophistication of its media operations, which really served multiple purposes. They were able to recruit new members. They were able to intimidate ISIS adversaries. And it was a global operation. This wasn't just some kind of local or parochial outfit that was pushing out messages that nobody read. I mean, people were consuming this ideology and then launching attacks. People were consuming this ideology and traveling to join the group.
That is Colin Clark, who's a senior research fellow at the Soufan Center and also author of the upcoming book, After the Caliphate, the Islamic State and the Future Terrorist Diaspora. Colin, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And here now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young, and thanks to Chuck Holmes and everyone at WBHM in Birmingham. Great quick visit. It's Here and Now.